so that we can put it on our website. Because, like for people who are shut in and so on, like Luke, or anyone who wants to listen to it. So that's the point. So,
if you aren't familiar with our website, it's...
mistnow.org, which is a kind of confusing name that stands for Meditation in Shambhala Tradition. mistnow.org.
There's also lots of past talks from all kinds of people on the website.
Yeah. So the interesting and ironic thing is, what I wanted to talk about tonight is actually on the topic of confidence and fear. And I am not approaching it from the perspective of being an expert in that. Like Trudy said, I recently became the coordinator of this group, and what that's done for me is make me realize how much I lack confidence and carry fear into all kinds of situations. So I'm not speaking as an expert in confidence. I'm speaking as a beginner who's desperately trying to find his way in that area. And confidence is actually really, really fundamental to a lot of Shambhala teachings, like the symbol with the yellow circle. That is the Great Eastern Sun. And that's all about confidence. Like in one of our chants, it talks about, you know, radiating confidence, illuminating the way of discipline, eternal ruler of the three worlds. That sun shines on us all. And one other chant I'll just mention, it talks, there's a symbol in Shambhala also called the Ashe. And a different chant says, Ashe fearlessly, that's the fear, fearlessly reveals confidence and compassion. And that's interesting in every way, because it's connecting fear, fearlessness and confidence and compassion. And you don't necessarily think of confidence and compassion as going together. That's what I wanted to kind of consider. And because it's been on my mind, I've been sort of looking into it, both in the teachings and just, you know, thinking about it. It's easy to get the kind of impression when you're talking about fear and confidence that fear is simply a bad thing, and you want to get rid of that, and confidence is simply a good thing, and you want to get more of that. And I think the teachings are actually a little bit more nuanced than that. If there's anything that Shambhala teachings that's more fundamental than talking about the confidence, it is the idea of basic goodness, which is, I was trying to touch on that in the meditation instruction, that basic goodness kind of implies that you already have everything that you need. That's one half of it. And another half of it is that everything you do have is in one way or another on a manifestation of your underlying basic goodness. And that specifically, I think, has to include fear. So fear can be a good thing. Confidence can be a negative thing. Mostly not, though. I mean, the teachings, you know, are mostly. You want confidence, you don't want fear. And how do you keep this all straight? Another useful thing that you hear sometimes in the teachings is the notion of a near enemy. That usually comes up when we're talking about compassion. Like a good thing, like compassion is a virtue, has a near enemy, which is pity. Pity is not virtuous. Pity is not a good thing. Compassion is, you know, like when you're opening your heart to another person and feeling them on a kind of a level basis, on a peer-to-peer basis. And that's wonderful. Pity, on the other hand, is you're sitting up on your mountaintop, looking down at that poor schmuck groveling in the muck, you know, and feeling pity for them. And yes, you're engaged with their suffering, but you're engaged from this position of superiority. So that's why they say, you know, that's very unhealthy for both of you. So they say pity is the near enemy of compassion. And what I'd like to suggest is that there is also similar kind of near enemies at play with fear and confidence. That fear, insofar as it is a bad thing, is the near enemy of a virtuous thing, which we don't talk about much, which is sort of like, the word would be something like prudence or something like that, or in Buddhist terms, discriminating awareness, where you look at a situation and you see it for what it is, including as part of that, its dangers, and you appreciate that, and you react intelligently in the face of that situation. That is a virtuous position. That's a virtuous action. Whereas fear is the near enemy of prudence, and fear is where you're just kind of wasting your time and energy fretting about either something that doesn't matter or something you can't control, and you're just wasting your energy. Similarly, with confidence. Confidence is virtuous, I think so. But there is a kind of a near enemy of confidence, which you would call like arrogance or something like that, where you fail to appreciate everything about the situation that you're in, and you blunder through it, making mistakes. And I've done both of those things, like in the last few weeks on many occasions. My natural habit is to bring too much fear into the situation, and so I screw up that way. But I've also done it the other way too, where I wasn't thinking of myself as being arrogant, but in fact I was coming into the situation without appreciating the situation fully, and as a result I kind of messed it up and did damage instead of being helpful, you know? So that's a piece of it. That's one thing. Yeah. And where do you get the ability to discern one from the other? And that, I think, is where meditation comes in. It always comes in to all these talks. One way to say what meditation is kind of learning not to take your thoughts so seriously, you know? Like you practice in the art of seeing a thought come and letting that thought go. Whereas when you're not a meditator, when the thought comes, it tends to kind of overwhelm you and you're lost and you're just carried away by that thought, like a surfer wiping out, you know? But if you have that kind of grounding in meditation, then you understand when that big thought, that big hairy, monstrous, fearful thought comes, you realize that, well, yes, I could actually let that go. It doesn't actually deserve that, all of that potency that I give to it. And similarly, when you're in a situation where you're arrogant, where you're not paying attention, the meditation practice tends to bring you back to being here and recognizing that moment when you understand that you have been lost and you say, oh, I've been gone, haven't I? I've not been here at all. That's a way of kind of cutting the arrogance of being carried away by our thoughts and returning to this situation that you're actually in. So that's part of it. That's half of what I wanted to say, I think. The other half is, we think of, especially we think of confidence as something that we're lacking, that we have to go out somewhere and get more of, you know? Like, my car doesn't go because I don't have gasoline. My life doesn't go because I don't have confidence. I take my car to the gas station and fill up the tank, and I take myself to the confidence station and fill up my tank. It doesn't work that way. And there again, the Shambhala teachings say you know, basic goodness. You have what you need already. And the way to connect with confidence is not to, like, reach out in the world and grab things. They suggest, and I think I agree with this, that if you settle your mind and let yourself brush away some of the crud that you carry around with you normally, you find they're already there waiting for you. Something that you might refer to as confidence, in the sense of, I can be in this situation. I don't have to let my fears dominate me here. It's a subtle kind of confidence. I mean, it's not at all grounded on feeling like you're better than anyone else. It's not like that at all. It's more like you don't have to bother with all that stuff. You don't have to bother with worrying about whether I'm better than you or worse than you or all that stuff. You could just drop that stuff, just like you drop other thoughts in meditation. And then you're left with, because you're not carrying all that extra baggage around, then you're left with just being actually in the situation as it is and addressing that instead of addressing all your neurotic stuff. And when you do that, then people look at you and say, wow, that person is confident, because they're not thrashing around in their agonizing over their ego stuff. They can just kind of be here in the situation, just like you are on the cushion. You're here at that time. Yeah. So I think that's all I really want to say. I mean, I hope it stimulates some comments from you, because I'd be very interested to hear what people have to say. It's like I'm working through this stuff, but that's where I am right now with this stuff. And I still screw up all the time. I mean, I still today screw up. But you have a bit of a more of a chance of holding your place, not being swept away. And you can approach your life even with a little bit of a sense of humor. In those times that you would have otherwise been in anguish, you can say, well, yeah, that's just me. That's that stuff that I do going off one more time. And just appreciate, you know, that that's part of being human. And it's okay. Yeah, I think that's enough. I'll stop. Does anyone have comments or questions?
I think we're all experts in fear.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to just touch on is I also wanted to distinguish between the kind of fear that is kind of neurotic fear and the kind of fear that is like really coping with real stuff, you know? Like, I have the luxury that I'm in a position in my life where most of my fears are just neurotic nonsense, you know? But, you know, a lot of people aren't in that situation. Like the people grappling with all the stuff in Nepal, or people who are very elderly, you know, with health challenges and everything. But still, I think it's all still true that the meditation is helpful and it lets you practice seeing, you know, setting thoughts aside as they come and being present with the situation as it is, instead of always filtering it through all of the lens of all your neurotic stuff. But yeah, you're right, we all feel fear.
Do we really set thoughts aside? I'm thinking that seems kind of... Or do you just sort of... I don't know if it would be see through them, but... actually just recognize them for what they are.
Yeah.
And then let go of them. But that seems different than...
So it's more like popping a soap bubble or something like that? Is that what you're... Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I have a feeling sometimes that, like, I just get tired of the thought. Like, now that I've been meditating for a while and I've learned to, like, notice the repetitive thoughts instead of be completely obsessed with them, it's not like they're not there, but I'm just, like, over it. Like, this thought, you know, like, here it comes again. Like, you know, and
yes.
I'm not afraid of it or anything, but I just, it bores me. Like, I'm just done with it. And then it tends to lose kind of its strength. But the same habitual thoughts seem to keep coming back. They don't go away. But I feel like...
For me, that's what I was talking about, humor. For me,
yeah.
The way that goes is it rouses my sense of the ridiculous. You know, like,
yeah.
You would think that I've had this thought 10,000 times, that the 10,001st,
right.
I could like just not. But no.
I think one of the most helpful things for me about dealing with fear, first of all, I think it's in, is it level 4 of the Shambhala training? We talk about fear, hope and fear. Sorry. Yeah. So the idea that fear is actually a way to try to keep things the same and to make them not change, I found very helpful. And then the practice of just being with your fear, and Thich Nhat Hanh says, hold your fear in your arms as if it were an infant.
Yeah.
And take care of it. And pay attention to it. Mm. And I found that that has really been, has that practice of being with my feelings that I would normally try to squash or get rid of, that actually being there with them and letting them be present has been, is making a big difference in how I am in the world. Mm-hmm. That I can be more confident because I'm more real, I guess I could say. I'm more real to myself in a way because all of those feelings and thoughts that I've just tried to get rid of in the past, I'm now saying, oh, well, gee, I need to pay attention. What is this thought? What is this feeling? And
yeah, that's so lovely. I mean, I've had thoughts that I say, oh, I can't possibly think that. I don't dare let myself feel that. Mm-hmm. You know, and so you like just tamp it down, you know, desperately. And then it always comes back up.
Whack-a-mole.
Yeah, yeah. So that's great. I mean, that's so nice. To let the idea of that thing, whatever it is that's bothering you, could be accepted and embraced, you know, and nurtured. Mm-hmm. You know, and like, yeah, it's a screwed up attempt to deal with a problem, but the problem that it's attempting to address is a real one. Mm-hmm. You know, and honor that and love it. You know, that's nice. Yeah,
I've seen fear can be a bridge to confidence, and I'm thinking of a bit more extreme situations. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should find something more moderate, but just I fell into a river and was in a very dangerous situation, and it was my fear that woke me up and put me in the moment in that situation.
Yes.
And there were things that I could do in that river as I was heading. I had no idea what was going to happen. There were things that I could do that I realized, and this probably was seconds, it felt like hours, but it was probably seconds where I went, oh, I could just relax with this because I kept hitting rocks.
So when you were in that moment, did you feel like you were afraid?
I was afraid, but my training came in. The confidence in my training, because I've had river training.
Yeah.
So the confidence in that training and knowing that if I stuck my feet, I saw a big rock coming up to me, and I stuck my feet at it, and I knew it would the current would swing me around to the back of the rock, and that it there would be an eddy. Uh-huh. There would be some place where I could rest maybe for a minute or so. I don't know. But I'm trying to think of like other ways, and not such an extreme situation, because I'm thinking, what is the bridge then to the confidence? Uh-huh. What is the sort of the partner you're talking about? The the partner that's sort of the negative of it. What's the partner that's the positive of it? That is the bridge to it. You know.
I think maybe it's what you said, waking you up. if you don't wallow in the fear, but you recognize the fear and open your mind and see what is there.
Yeah.
That could be.
That's the, I think, the notion of, Shambhala always talks about unconditional confidence as opposed to, you know, I've learned this thing so well that now I'm really confident I can do it. But it seems as though it's the notion of if you're really present and you realize that nothing, there's no situation you can't be present in. Mm. And it's the being present that's the confidence, you know, that you have confidence in yourself, in your being, that I can be present. And when I'm present, I can handle situation.
Yeah.
You know, I may get beat up, I may die, whatever.
Yeah. I can still, there's that thing where you just say, well, I don't know what's going to happen here. But so what's happening like right now?
Yeah.
There's this big rock. you know, maybe I could use it, you know.
Well, that puzzles me a little because, like, you know, when I've been in a crisis like that, it doesn't feel like I'm afraid. It feels like I am totally, totally, totally present. You know, in this, I'm not thinking about anything else. I'm just saying. There was one time in my life I managed to cut into my leg with a chainsaw, and I was alone. And I said, you know, the thought flickered across my mind. I really might, you know, be dead half an hour from now if I don't do this right. You know, and I did it right, and I was fine. You know, but I mean, I didn't feel like I was afraid. I just felt like that I really have to get this right. Right now.
But maybe the fear is this discernment, you know, being able to discern what's happening here.
Yeah.
I need to, you know, I can't just like float around here. I gotta like kind of figure something out as best I can, try to, you know, use my mind in this situation. So maybe it's more of a, but the basis of it is fear. Like if I don't do anything here, if I don't use what I have, whatever that is, I don't know what it is from moment to moment, it could be dire, like you were saying. You know, if I didn't, you know, if I just sort of sit down and go, wow, I really cut my, you know, it's like, no, I gotta like move. I know I have to move. It'll start bleeding more, but I know I have to move someplace so that someone knows my situation. You know?
Right.
So maybe it's more discernment at that point.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's actually what confidence is. Just I didn't recognize it because it didn't feel like it in that situation. I don't know.
I think of confidence as resourcefulness, and that we actually have what it takes to be resourceful in some way. If that means asking for help, if that means handling something like either of you two did. I think it's so much more subtle, the fear that permeates one's or erodes that confidence. When there aren't dire things happening and you just are caught up in your habitual way of being.
I think Barbara touched on something which was like when you're, what fear is about is sort of a sense of poverty, of lacking stuff. Whereas when you're in that kind of a crisis, you don't bother with that. You just think, okay, what do I have that I can use to get out of this emergency? You
know? And it's not confidence in knowing what's going to happen next. You have no ground. I mean, literally, you have no ground. But you have no ground. So you don't know, like Bill was saying, you could die. You know, I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities here.
Yeah.
But that's true in those little situations, too. But we think we know. We think
we try to know, you know.
Or we, because we've had such and such happen, we think it's going to happen that way again. And we don't have the confidence to take a fresh look or be fresh about it or be open.
I listened to a talk by Zigar Contro Rinpoche just a couple weeks ago, and he was talking about how bad we screw things up wanting to be special all the time. And this fear, and it goes back to fear, and like this fear of not being special, and how much of our time we spend like trying to say the right thing, trying to do just something to be special in a situation. And he talked about how good it can feel to give that up, like quit wanting to be special, or like give up the fear of not being special. You're, you know, like you're just another person, and like recognizing how often you do that, and I do it, I've done it my whole life, and it goes back to that confidence. Like, in a given situation, once you stop wanting to stand out as special in some way, you can embrace the moment for what it really is. And he didn't mention fear specifically, but he was talking about wanting to feel special. And I think that, for me at least, my whole life, like, I wanted to, like, hey, you know, look at me, I'm good at this, or look at what I can do. And it's a pain in the ass to live your life like that. You know? And that's just this little situation in everyday life, that there is fear behind that of, like, not being special.
Not being silly. Recognized.
One thing I've been thinking a lot about lately, which is interesting that you started talking about confidence, one of those serendipities, but is the relation between body and mind for confidence. Because they talk a lot about, like, strike a power pose for 5 minutes and then you'll be confident. But I've noticed I've always been quite shy, and it's been more recently in life that I've been able to speak in front of people. But I still, even though my mind feels okay in many ways, I still get physiological responses like hives or things like that that remain out of my control, even if my mind feels at ease. So it's been interesting to me to just think about that relation between mind and body, and wonder, like, even if I feel okay on this mental level, is a physical manifestation in the body evidence that it's not gone deep enough and I'm still kind of just treading water? I'm not sure what to make of it, but it's kind of an interesting relationship.
Yeah, I think our bodies have habitual patterns also. You know, so you've worked on the one in your mind, but the body's waiting. So it'll eventually catch up.
Catch up.
Yeah, like there you are talking, your body's going, oh shit, she's talking. And you're going, and I'm feeling more confident. Oh God, I don't know. That there's still, your body's still going, well, I don't know if I'm okay with that, brain. And your brain's going, look, we're good, you know, I'm feeling pretty confident, this feels relaxed, so I can speak, you know. But yeah,
I googled it and it was like, try to control your anxiety. And then the other option was stop eating gluten, and I was like, that's not the answer to everything.
Yes, it is.
Well, congratulations, because I think that the mind and the body are inseparable, except that we don't always know that. So when you change one aspect of your behavior, it may take time, but something shifts there as well, could shift.
I've always felt when, like, if I'm having trouble with a decision or I'm not quite sure about something, that if I pull my shoulders back and stand up straight, and I think it opens you to the world. And like, for me, I make better decisions that way. If I'm indecisive, kind of like being accountable to the world or being accountable to other people, because when you're up and you're straight, then, you know, there will be communication. And there's no doubt, like, if you see what happens to, I've worked with, like, some troubled teens and whatnot, and, like, it's a confidence thing, but their posture tends to go down to here, and especially if you can wear a hoodie, you know, and really close in. And I always tell them, like, if you're having trouble with the decision, pull the hood back and straighten up, and it does, I feel it brings confidence of some sort, at least temporarily.
And breathing,
yeah. And you breathe better when you are, you know, I mean, your circulation's better, and so your brain actually works better when you're straight.
Right, and when you're straight, actually, your heart is exposed, so there's that piece of it, too, even without, that somehow might lend itself to communication.
This vulnerability and that sort of, you know, just to be open to everybody And I've been thinking a lot about what's going on in the world right now, and you know, how we've probably been. There was a time when we were really truly had some fears about you know, maybe being attacked and eaten by a lion or whatever. And I don't know the last time I actually was in a situation that truly warned, you know, I have fear every day, and yet I don't have any situation that's threatening my life or ultimately my ego either. And I think this is an ego thing. I think it's we've abstracted fear like we abstract everything. We abstract God, and we put words in front of things which do more to limit, you know, a concept than open it up. You know, so we have universities where we try to clamp everyone and put them in a box, you know, and say, all our institutions are, please don't, you know. And there's, you know, Brene Brown was talking about there's no creativity really without a vulnerability.
Yeah.
And that, and any, you know, any entity that that wants to succeed will have to be vulnerable. People will have to open themselves up. And I think that's the thing. I think that's probably the main issue we're dealing with now. And it takes some sort of prudence, the word that was used earlier, and discernment and being in the moment. And, you know, the Quakers would call it bearing witness, you know.
Yeah.
You're there right with the situation. And the million other concepts out there that are all talking about the same thing. And it helps me to remember that, because, you know, I've been dealing with a lot of fear, looking at all the nutty stuff about conspiracy stuff on the internet, not because I want to scare myself necessarily, but because I want to discern the little elements of truth that are behind what these sides are afraid of, you know. And it doesn't matter whether it's conventional or, and now there doesn't seem to be a lot of difference between the conventional nuttiness and the specific nuttiness, conspiracy theories and all this other, you know, rot. So it all looks like rot to me. So we're bringing it to some kind of head where we really are going to have something to fear, which is planetary destruction. And yet, I also have to remind myself that we can make an intention, a majority of us at some point can make an intention of not giving into this irrationality and being right there with the moment and really, and make an intention that we want to heal this. And if anyone has any ideas, I'd love to hear them. But it is dealing with our individual fear and talking about our you know, our neurotic fantasies, which is all this stuff is about.
What I would say is that I would take a golden thread and I would weave in kindness into all that somehow. Just weave it right in. Because if all, whatever it is not based on kindness, then it's not sustainable. Okay?
I think maybe related to what Dan was talking about, one of the big reasons for fear is not wanting to be vulnerable. And in many situations, people act out of fear, trying to protect themselves or their ideas or their concepts or their possessions or their position. And once you have an open heart, well, I won't say once, I'll say in the moments when you have an open heart, then you realize you don't need that kind of false armor, because the other people in the situation with you are just like you.
Yeah, I think almost every problem in the world, from little to big, you can relate back to just self-cherishing. you know, just make wanting to protect you or you and yours, you know, in one way or another. I mean, it all kind of comes down to that. And that, when that's what everyone's doing, it just doesn't work out very well.
Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of a ironic tragedy there, which is like, when we, you know, set up our turf of the things we want to protect, I think we're, at least I, tend to be really kind of unimaginative about that. And so frequently I've had the case where something comes along and knocks over that thing that I have been trying to protect. Mm-hmm. And it comes out great. It comes out better than, you know, that I had hoped. I mean, you know, it was like actively misguided to be working to protect that stuff that actually was better off without it. You know, totally amazing when that happens. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah, you hold on to certain things so tight because you think you need them so bad, but then finally when they're gone, you're like free of it and things are way easier.
Well, I think that's the point of meditation, is that all these things we think we are and we need, we find out that's not who we are or what we need. We've been playing a joke on ourselves and we haven't seen the punchline or something.
I always try to find that place where one day I was walking down a road and I thought, I could just keep walking. I don't need all that stuff that's behind me. Could I just keep going? And that, like that day I thought I could keep going. Huh. When I try to recreate it. No, I just need that.
Yeah.
I don't really need my bike or my car. Or, you know, people. That would be the only thing. I couldn't really. Like, if I dig deep, I can't walk away from people.
Well, I guess the other, maybe the punchline is, you know, eventually you're going to die and all these things you want and need. Sorry. So, yeah, so I guess meditating would help. Might make that transition a little easier.
I'm still with the golden thread.
Yeah.
In a way, and what you said. Our current teacher, Sakyong Mikong, I think that's really what he's trying to do, is shift that dynamic that you talked about of kind of paranoia and so forth by using our practice and learning to trust that we're okay and there's no mistake and we actually can make contact with others and we can impact society in some small way, but every small way is a little piece of sand in the great beach of life. I just thought of that.
No, but I mean, you're right. And it's like we think each of us, I think, falls into the habit of thinking that it's just we're alone and we have to like protect ourselves and everybody else has it together, but we're alone and we're messed up, you know. And part of the Shambhala teachings and the community stuff is to understand that you actually can, you know, connect with other people and that's okay. To do that, and it's fine, you know, and they will be there. I mean, you know, what an astonishing thing. If you've lived your life sort of in fear and loneliness, you know, to understand that you could actually connect, that's extraordinary.
Well, it is on the other side of that, there is the notion that of aloneness being the source of your wish to connect. That kind of, I mean, that is a piece of what we talk about when we talk about warriorship too, is accepting or realizing how alone you are and how in some way, I guess, I don't know, I don't want to use a lot of those words, so.
No, but there's, so I mean, you can, aloneness as a kind of a treasure instead of as a shameful secret that you must.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think another kind of fear that I have a lot in everyday life is situations coming up that I think is going to be challenging, and I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to make things work the way I think they should work. I'm right. not going to be able to do it right myself. Uh-huh. And one of the great things for me about being in the Shambhala community is the teaching that doesn't matter. Yeah. What matters is you're all here together, working together in this situation. And if it doesn't go the way you thought, I thought it should go, well, then you're still there in the situation with your Sangha, working together. Uh-huh. And it might not be full of harmony. I was so dismayed in the beginning when I first started belonging to the Sangha. I remember, where is the peace and harmony? No. And finally, I figured it out that, or I guess it was just experience and hearing teachers and working with people who'd been there a lot longer than I had. So, well, okay, so there's a problem. We're working together. It's not the end of the world. They didn't do it my way. Okay, never mind. There are other ways to do it. And that I began realizing a few years into meditating. That was a real big source of fear for me in my everyday life. I carried that around with me. I still do.
It's related to equanimity. It's like you are guaranteed that it won't work out the way you think.
That's right.
That will not happen. But it'll work out some other way. And you can deal with that. Yeah. So it's like.
And it's the process that is important. It's not. Yeah. I was always, in my whole life, until I began meditating, so focused on an end result. And it was my end result. So, big change.
I just want to say, and I'm just sort of throwing it out because I don't know what this is, but the word trust and confidence and sort of the so I may trust that somehow things will be okay. I don't know what that is, but something about things will be okay. They may not look like I thought that they should, or I may not have been able to manipulate something. That maybe I don't have to do any of that. I don't have to manipulate anything. Well, I don't know what I'd do with my day, you know? Really, because it seems like a lot of it's about manipulation, you know, manipulating things. And, you know, to my credit, I've gotten kudos for, I do a great job manipulating stuff. I do this, and I do this, and then I connect those things together. And so it's not bad. But underneath it is a lack of trust. I don't trust that if I don't stick my two cents in there all the time, that things will work out okay, whatever that means. That's what I don't know, is what it's going to look like eventually. And that's when my fear comes up. So, but this thing about trust and confidence, you know, I think they're married. Maybe those are the they live together, you know. It's just the opposite side of the coin.
I think the we have four dignities up there: the tiger, lion, Garuda, and dragon. And the notion of the Garuda is that you're present when you're present. you have some. You do something, you know, when you're in some situation, you do something. And the trust there is that you'll find out what the result was. And the idea in the Garuda is you don't have any hope or fear. You drop your hope and your fear, and you look at the situation, and you do something. And because you don't have hope and fear, you're not disappointed by what happens, or you're not elated by what happens. You just see what happens, and then you know what to do the next shot. So it's a trust that you'll get some feedback as to what happened. Very different from the notion of trusting that I'll get what I want if I do this. Because it doesn't work.
Or being afraid that what's going to happen is just going to be horrible or something. Yeah, so if you don't have the hope and fear, you know, I fear I'm going to mess up, I hope I don't.
Yeah.
Because they're like this, you know. then whatever happens is like, okay.
But you have to have something.
Yeah, be aware.
So you have this wing, you have this wing. Hope over here, fear over here. There's something here.
Yeah.
That is actually keeping you aloft.
Mm-hmm. Your basic goodness.
Yeah. And that we can trust. Well, that we are hoping, or we're working to learn to trust. Mm-hmm. That's the image somebody used of this. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, actually taking every piece of you and learning to love it in some way, or accept it.
I feel like I've always, even before I really studied Buddhism, thought about impermanence a lot. It's just always on my mind, all the time. And I have a lot of confidence in impermanence. And I find that gives me a lot of confidence, because there's a lot of times when I'm worried about something. I mean, I really think literally, you're just going to die. So it really doesn't matter. I mean, none of it really matters. I know things matter. We got to help people. And the thing that matters is love. But really, like, if you're really caught up and wound up in your mind, I think that thought of, I'm just going to die, and it's fine. You know, then it's not going to matter. For me, that is really helpful. Yeah. I have a lot of confidence in that, you know, confidence in impermanence. No matter what, it's going to change, no matter what. Yeah. If it's good, don't get too excited. If it's bad, don't get too down. It's going to change. And it does. It always does.
Or as Bill says, Monday morning, it'll all be over. It's like, yeah, you know, oh, how's it going to go? You know, because Monday morning, it'll just all be over. You know, so...
I think we need to stop.
Yes.
We don't have time for announcements.
We have 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Well, quickly, I wanted to say for Health and Well-Being Group, which is one of our resource groups, that we have an ongoing support group, which is an open support group, and it's contemplative-based. And it's facilitated by a longtime community member and psychotherapist, Dr. James Evans.